I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Our Conversations with the Candidates series continues today with Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. 4 years ago, when Mosby challenged then-incumbent State's Attorney Greg Bernstein, she said,
"The State's Attorney is the only one failing to obtain convictions, failing to engage communities, failing to administer justice fairly, failing to break down what has become a culture of distrust in this city."
As Marilyn Mosby runs for re-election in this month's primary, her opponents are faulting her for many of the same reasons. Mosby points to a formidable conviction rate, progress in addressing witness intimidation, and legislative victories, as well as programs for young people that will help fix what she herself has called a broken criminal justice system. Marilyn Mosby joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today we continue our series of conversations with the candidates with Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. She is running for re-election in the Democratic primary that takes place on the 26th of this month. Early voting begins on Thursday. She is opposed by two other candidates, Ivan Bates and Thiru Vignaraja. The winner of the primary will run unopposed in the general election. Marilyn Mosby drew international attention when she indicted six Baltimore police officers in the police custody death of Freddie Gray in 2015. None of those indictments resulted in a conviction, but Ms. Mosby points to a 95% conviction rate to date for her office overall. The state's attorney's office prosecuted more than 41,000 cases last year. In addition to the violence that rocked the city following the funeral of Freddie Gray, the police department has been in nearly constant turmoil since Marilyn Mosby was elected in 2014. There have been four police commissioners in the last 3.5 years. The city is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice, and eight members of the elite gun trace task force were convicted of running an extensive criminal enterprise. The leader of the GTTF was sentenced to 25 years in prison on Wednesday. Ms. Mosby oversees a staff of 400-plus employees, including more than 200 attorneys. Her annual salary is the highest of any Baltimore City official. She received a presidential scholarship from Tuskegee University, where she graduated with a BA in political science. She holds a law degree from the Boston College Law School. She is 38 years old. She is married to 40th District Delegate Nick Mosby, and they live in Reservoir Hill with their two very beautiful daughters. We are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page today, and a little later in the show, we'll take your calls and comments. Madam State's Attorney, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Always a pleasure to see you as well, Tom.
So let's talk about the thing that I started talking about with the other two gentlemen in this race, and that is the capacity of your office and you as the state's attorney to reduce crime. Are there particular things that you're sure that you can do individually and you can do in your office that are going to somehow lessen, attenuate the people on the street who are shooting each other, who are robbing folks, who are committing assaults? I mean, what are the things specifically that you all have the capacity to do?
So I think that, you know, when we look at the traditional sort of a role of a prosecutor, the prosecutor at the point somebody has made a poor decision is when they usually come in contact with a prosecutor, right? They've already broken the law. And we've had this traditional sort of reactive approach. And I think when you talk about metrics, you can look. You've cited some of the really bad and kind of unprecedented external challenges that we've had in this city, from the untimely death of Freddie Gray, to uprising, Department of Justice report exposing discriminatory policing practices, consent decree, the full implementation of body-worn cameras on all officers. You know, where they were reenacting the discovery and seizure of evidence, one of the largest police corruption scandals in the history of this country, the opioid crisis that we've been dealing with that is reminiscent of the crack epidemic, you know, having to work with four police commissioners in 3 years. When you consider all of those external sort of factors and challenges that we've had as a city, you know, when we look at the traditional reactive approach, my prosecutors, as you stated, prosecuted 41,000 cases last year. we still, there's a level of unprecedented distrust among communities and law enforcement. And yet we still had a 95% conviction rate. We've convicted every single public enemy number one that's been designated by the Baltimore Police Department. You know, if you prey upon the vulnerabilities of men, women, children, seniors, we're going to hold you accountable. Those individuals, 6 life sentences plus 700 years. But for far too long, people in this role have not taken a proactive approach. And, you know, that's something that I've attempted to do in these past 3 years. Prior to taking office, I traveled all across the country to different district attorney's offices to see what best practices we can employ in Baltimore City, because I understood the importance of getting to the root causes, systemic issues as to why crimes take place. You can't just be reactionary, and you have to be proactive. What does that mean? You know, when we look at our city, located in one of the richest states in the entire country, you can no longer continue to ignore the fact that 24% of Baltimore's population lives in poverty, 35% of children live below poverty, there are over 18,000 vacant houses, 16,000 vacant lots, the unemployment rate for young African-American men between the ages of 18 and 24, which is more than twice as high than that of whites. We put all of this investment in public safety, but my little girls are in Baltimore City public schools. You can remember when we made national news when our babies were in the classrooms in their coats. Where is that investment
but
in
again,
public education?
But how can the state's attorney's office move that dial?
What I can tell you is that what I've attempted to do is to take a more holistic approach. So I created a crime control and prevention division, for example. It wasn't in existence before. Why did I do that? Well, last year I charged twice as many juveniles with attempted murder and murder than almost the past 2 years combined. That's the reason why, you know, I've made it my mission to ensure that we're getting to young people before they get to the criminal justice system. You know, we have 3 youth programs. I have a youth coordinator, the only state attorney's office in the entire state that has one, where essentially we go into the schools. We have 2 schools in West Baltimore, 1 in East Baltimore, where we focus on 4th and 5th graders and essentially expose them to positive careers in the criminal justice system. I'm sure you can remember when we had officer friendly in our schools. There was a rapport that we had with law enforcement that we now lack. We have another program, our junior state's attorneys, that I'm extremely proud of, right? We've touched more than 200 young people just in that program, where they start in the beginning of a criminal case in the 911 call center to the Evans Control Room, Foxtrot, Federal Circuit, District Court, and at the culmination of the 6 weeks when we complain about young people not having much to do, they do a mock trial competition at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where they can then see themselves as judges and prosecutors and police. We just launched our 3rd youth program, which focuses on chronically truant young people. Why is a prosecutor doing something like this? Well, we know chronically truant means they're not coming to school 50 and 60% of the time. So why am I focusing on them? Because if they're not coming to school 50 and 60% of the time, they're 11th and 12th graders, what do you think they're going to end up in the criminal justice system?
But that's a good allocation of resources, because folks might hear that and say, those are all really, really commendable things. However, maybe that's for the mayor's office to do. Maybe that's Department of Social Services. Maybe that's for the schools to do, and that the prosecutor should concentrate on prosecuting the crimes.
And I would say that I disagree. I think that when you look at the effectiveness of my office, I'm no way in form or fashion taking away from that reactive approach. I just gave you those stats. 95% felony conviction rate. You know, there was a Baltimore Sun article where they were talking about there's been a 3% decline from 2014 to now, but in light of all of these external challenges. So we're in no way, form or fashion, taking away from being reactive and ensuring that we're holding violent repeat offenders accountable, but we also have to ensure that we're being proactive and we develop long-term sustainable solutions in how to reduce crime. That's the reason why we have those youth programs. That's the reason why I've dedicated so much of my time and resources into understanding and recognizing the most important stake in the criminal justice system is the community. We have increased the grant funding in my office by more than 31%. We got the largest federal grant we've ever received in the state attorney's office, $2.4 million, in the home of witness intimidation, where the stop snitching mentality began, to be able to better protect victims and witnesses of crime. I went down to Annapolis and I created a policy and legislative affairs division within my office, understanding that it can't just be reactionary, right? You have to also be down in Annapolis and ensuring that we're getting the proper funding and the particular laws that impact our communities. We went down and we advocated. We got an additional $360,000 of state-mandated funding for victims and witnesses of crime, because for the past 3 years, we've experienced a 30% increase in violent crime and requests for relocation, but the funding wasn't meeting those demands. And so I said, I'm going to do everything in my power to protect people. So we overspent our budget for the past 3 years by $150,000 to $300,000. Thanks to my policy and legislative affairs team and that advocacy, we now have state mandated funding. We just renovated the victim witness waiting room. And like, this may sound trivial unless and until you're a victim or a witness to an armed carjacking and you have to rearrange your schedule. You go into court and walk the halls with the individual that you've accused of that offense and their friends. And then you have to go into a dark, dank, dingy room for hours on end until your case is called. That in and of itself can be anxiety provoking. So we partnered with an architectural firm that redeveloped that space based upon therapeutic design. So everything from the color of the floor to the now living green wall and that's plastered in the middle of that space, and the smart furniture that you can plug in right into the internet and not be disconnected from your life. You know, we did that. It's based upon those that have experienced trauma and how to make them feel more secure in those environments.
And see, that kind of thing is very difficult to quantify in any metric. You know, the case that you made to the public when you ran against Greg Bernstein and when you started that campaign, no one gave you a chance. They thought this is an inexperienced young prosecutor. You ended up being the youngest elected state's attorney in the country. They didn't give you a chance, and you made the case to voters that your predecessor wasn't convicting enough people, and conviction rates seemed to be the metric that was important to you then. I mean, is that, first of all, the best, most valid metric that voters should use to assess your performance or the performance of anybody in this office?
So what I will say is that if you're looking for metrics, you have to be able to break down barriers of distrust, right? And I've done that through all of my community. I created a community engagement division. We have community days in court where we open up the doors of the courthouse to the community to talk about the intricacies of the criminal justice system. You know, I have community liaisons that we've re-implemented that are the face of the office into the community and also the voice of the community back to the office. But the way I think that you can quantify that is we can look at what happened with former Commissioner Daryl D'Souza. Right. He went in front of a jury and testified, and they didn't necessarily that level of distrust because of all of those external factors, not necessarily because of his own personal credibility, but all of those external factors came into play. Right. And they said, we don't believe that that happened the way that it did. And we don't have it on body worn cameras. So guess what? We're going to find that person not guilty. Well, when you look at all of the external challenges that we have had as a city, the fact that we can look to my conviction rate and see that we are still on par, we have been able to break down those barriers of distrust. And I think it's incumbent on the state's attorney to be able to do that. Because when I was a line assistant, what I found when I was going in and trying attempted murders and robberies and carjackings was that people were so distrustful of the criminal justice system that even when they felt somebody was guilty, they weren't inclined to convict. And I felt that it was incumbent on the state's attorney to be able to break down those barriers of distrust. And that's what we've attempted to do.
So if the conviction rate is important, you know, what does that say about should people judge you and your office on the number of crimes that are committed, the number of homicides, you know, which are actually down a little bit this year, but up considerably from the 4 years of your predecessor? I mean, is just the conviction rate, because there are those who would also suggest that the calculation for the conviction rate in your administration is done slightly differently than it was done in previous administrations. It doesn't include, for example, dropped cases. So they're saying it's not apples and apples, it's apples and oranges.
And what I would say is, and they've already confirmed, the Baltimore Sun has confirmed through an expert that the way that I calculate my convictions is accurate. You know, you wouldn't include, just because you make an arrest for an individual, a dropped case, if you cannot legally proceed upon that case, you shouldn't include that in the calculation of your conviction rate. I follow the standards of the Association for Prosecuting Attorneys, right? So at the end of the day, we're going to proceed. We had several sort of examples where the 163-page report that exposed the discriminatory policing practices of the 8th largest police department in the country, you know, if in fact we get a case where there's an arrest and it's an unconstitutional arrest, why would it make sense for us to legally, we cannot proceed upon that case to include that in my conviction rate? So we look at the cases that had to be thrown out as a result of the body-worn cameras, right? These are credibility issues. So the way that we calculate the conviction rate is accurate, and that's been confirmed on numerous occasions.
So one of your opponents, Mr. Bates, by his calculation says that your office won 175 trial cases but lost 237. Is that true?
No, it's not. And unfortunately, and this is one of my, transparency has been the hallmark of my administration. If you look on our website, we're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, last week, I put out 7 years worth of data about conviction rates, the disposition of cases and why they were steaded, why they were no-prost. I'm not sure why.
No-prost means to be dropped.
Yeah,
it means
to be dismissed.
Instead, it means to be taken off the
correct.
Docket.
I have nothing to hide. So I'm not certain where my opponent is getting his numbers, but unfortunately, there's been a lot of misinformation about what's happening in my office, which is why I felt it was important to be as transparent as possible.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll take some calls, questions, and comments. We will continue our conversation with Marilyn Mosby after a quick break. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are, of course, streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Early voting in this month's primary begins Thursday. The election is June 26th. Coming up tomorrow on Midday, an exploration into the state of voting in the midterm elections. The intelligence community has concluded that Russia meddled in the 2016 elections. In at least 8 states, voting laws governing the election are more stringent than they were the last time, and new rules in more than 20 states are tougher and more restrictive than they were just 8 years ago. So what does that mean for ease and accessibility of voting and the possibilities for voter disenfranchisement? John Willis is the former Maryland Secretary of State. Kristen Clark is with the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under the Law. Max Feldman is with the Brennan Center for Justice. And Nikita Robinson is the founder of Black Girls Vote. They will join me tomorrow to talk about the state of voting in this 2018 midterm election cycle. If you're just joining us today, we're continuing our series of conversations with the candidates. Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby is my guest. She's being challenged for the Democratic nomination for that position by Thiru Vignaraja and Ivan Bates. The winner of the primary will run unopposed in the general election. You are welcome to join our conversation here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my handle is @TomHallWIPR, and you can also ping us on Facebook. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Madam State's Attorney, we've got a few folks who want to weigh in with some comments. Maya in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Sure. I heard Marilyn Mosby speak at a neighborhood meeting in Waverly, a panel on juvenile justice, where the assumption was made by her that we all agreed with her that certain juveniles should be sent to adult prisons rather than juvenile prisons. But I don't agree with that, and I'm pretty sure a number of my neighbors don't, because adult prisons focus on punishment, whereas juvenile prisons focus on rehabilitation. And even though a young person may have committed a heinous crime, I believe they're still young enough to be changed, to improve themselves. And I'm wondering if Marilyn Mosby would comment on
all right,
that.
Well, thanks for that, Carl. So juvenile justice, of course, very much in the news with this recent tragedy up in Baltimore County with Officer Caprio being, allegedly run over in a car by a 16-year-old kid who was in the juvenile justice system.
Right. Well, Maya, I appreciate your call. I make no assumptions about what it is that you or anybody else may support. What I've stated was that, you know, I support the way that the laws are currently written. And if you, as a juvenile, commit first-degree murder, first-degree rape, first-degree assault, handgun, and the commission of a crime of violence, I believe that you should start automatically, as is currently the law, in adult jurisdiction. You then have the ability of appealing to a court and considering five factors: the age of the child, the size of the child, the nature of the offense, the amenability of the child to services, to request that that child be transferred back down to juvenile court. And what we've noticed when we look at the increase in youth violence, and there's been an increase in youth violence for last year, from 2014 to current, there was almost a 44% increase in the number of juveniles that are committing the more heinous offenses that are being transferred back down to juvenile court. I'm very well aware of the fact that the mission of the juvenile system is rehabilitation, and the adult system is about retribution. I'm very much aware of the fact that I want to ensure that we get to young people before it's too late, whether it's the pop-ups, whether it's my youth initiatives. But once you make a decision to hurt somebody, once you put a gun to a woman's head with a baby in their arms and pull that trigger, I believe that you should be held accountable. And the way in which, I'm not saying every single case should be left in adult court, but you should have to prove to the judge why it should be sent back down. And for the past 2 years, I've gone down to Annapolis, me and my policy and legislative affairs division, to advocate that we keep the laws the way that they are.
Why should it be mandatory? Why couldn't a prosecutor make a decision based on each individual case as to whether or not to do it in juvenile court or adult?
So that's what happens right now, Tom. So right now, they automatically start in adult jurisdiction. However, based upon those five factors, my prosecutors may, in fact, agree that the child should be sent back down to juvenile, or we will go in and oppose any sort of request to have that child transferred back down to juvenile.
You've said that the juvenile justice system is inherently broken.
It is.
There are many people who agree with you on that score. In this case of this young man, Duante Harris, he was supposedly in home detention in the juvenile services system.
Uh-huh.
Did your prosecutors do what they could do to keep him more closely monitored?
So what I can tell you is that I can tell you, because this is a confidential sort of system, in that particular case, I think the mom has gone on record and indicated that she asked for her son to be detained, as well as my office. So I can leave it there. But I can also tell you that with the juvenile justice system, we all know that it's broken, which is why I created the Crime Control and Prevention Division. But I think it's also really important for us to say, okay, how are we going to change it? How are we going to reform the criminal justice system, especially juvenile justice system? And one of the things I think that we need more coordination with is the Department of Juvenile Services in schools. We need to provide behavioral and mental health assessments to some of these young people. You know, that was something that was being opposed by Department of Juvenile Services last year in Annapolis. We also need to ensure that we have substance abuse programming for young people with prescription pills that we're seeing at a record level. You know, these are some of the changes and reforms that need to take place when it comes to making that assessment and really, truly rehabilitating our young people.
I mean, given the fact that, as you mentioned, the mother is in the public record saying that she begged people to incarcerate him, the son.
To detain him,
rather than have him on house arrest. I mean, what were your hands tied? Was there nothing that you could do by you? I mean, the prosecutorial team here, was there nothing that they could do to see that he was detained? Was this the judge's decision? Was this the department's decision? It sounds like I can't speak specifically
about this case other than what the mom has publicly said on the record. And the mom has publicly said on the record that she, as well as my prosecutors, prosecutors were asking for that young man to be detained. You know, the ultimate decision with regard to him being on home detention, I believe that's already been reported upon on various media stations and news outlets where, you know, the question is something that's being determined by the Department of Juvenile Services in the courts.
Let's go to the phones again. Angela in Mount Vernon, welcome to Midday with State's Attorney Mosby.
Yes, good afternoon. When State Attorney Mrs. Mosby decided to prosecute the officers who were a part of the Freddie Gray incident, what I heard from a lot of people was that Mrs. Mosby was acting more of an advocate than as an attorney. And what I have seen during her tenure is that she has taken a, as she said, kind of a comprehensive approach, a systems approach with dealing with everything that's been going on in our criminal justice system. She's been proactive and trying to deal with things in a more holistic manner.
And what's
and
your
I'm
question?
Wondering, my question is, if from her point of view, why is it that she's been deemed more of an advocate and not doing her job instead of being a trailblazer?
Well, I don't quite know who's deeming you an advocate as opposed to a prosecutor, but if for the moment at least accept Angela's premise there, what do you think?
And Angela, I appreciate your comment. One of the things I've just realized, I've learned how not to internalize it, right? At the end of the day, those 4 months into my term when an innocent man, 25-year-old man, made eye contact with police, was unconstitutionally arrested, was placed in a wagon, head first, feet shackled and handcuffed, his spine partially severed in the back of that wagon, and his pleas for medical attention were subsequently ignored. I followed the facts with the law, and I wouldn't do anything differently. I charged those that were deemed responsible, that legally we could deem responsible for his death. And
one of your opponents suggested it was a novel legal theory that you were testing in the cases with Ms. Bledsoe and Mr. Schatzer, who prosecuted the cases, that the investigation that you did was done hastily, that it was done too quickly, that you could have walked out on the steps of the War Memorial that day, and instead of announcing indictments, you could have said, look, folks, I need more time. We're looking into this. We're on the case.
So I had more information in that case than we do in a lot of other cases that we charge. We have probable cause in charge in murder cases. I had 5 admissions. In any event, like when I look at what happened, and there's going to be people who are upset that I did something in challenging the status quo. You know, holding police officers accountable was not happening all across this country. But when you think about that accountability ultimately led to exposure. A week after I charged those officers, the Department of Justice came in, exposed the unconstitutional practices and the discriminatory practices of the 8th largest police department in the country. That exposure ultimately led to reform. We now have a federally enforceable consent decree that even despite the Trump administration that tried to forestall it is on record. And because of that reform, we have a spotlight on the entrenched police corruption of the 8th largest police department in the country. Now, I always say justice is always worth the price paid for its pursuit. Those individual officers weren't held individually and criminally responsible, but every single police officer is now being held accountable for the actions of a few. I would not do anything differently.
Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby is my guest. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming also on the Facebook page at WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Jacob, welcome to the program with State's Attorney Mosby.
Hi, Tom. Big fan of the show. Big fan of your work, and thanks for all you do. Big fan of State's Attorney Mosby. This question is kind of following up on Sheila Cass' question to Ms. Mosby earlier in her administration. She declined to talk about the attrition directly following and firings directly following her taking power. And I've heard a lot of talk about high attrition rates up to 75% in her office, people quitting in disgust, people quitting for political reasons, people being generally, dissatisfied, discarded.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the percentages that you're throwing around there, Jacob, are not at all confirmable, but we get the gist of your question. When Greg Bernstein came into office, about 55 people left the office and he replaced them. When you came into office, as far as I know, it was about 105. So it is considerably more than the last administration. What should people make of that?
So what I can say is that when I first took office, let's just be clear, I let go of only six people. There's this misconception. It was a whole bunch of media that talked about this massacre within my office. My predecessor let go of a lot more. But besides all of that, we all know that change. I went into this to reform the criminal justice system. I knew that office very well. I was a law clerk in that office. And what I can tell you is that change is difficult. And it was no longer business as usual. So throughout the course of the 3 years, we were charging police officers. We were holding everybody accountable. You know, we were implementing reform, taking a holistic approach. And we've recruited a diverse, mission-oriented prosecutors who believe in justice over convictions, who understand the importance of getting in the community and being engaged. There's this misconception that my prosecutors are somehow less experienced. And the data shows us that the average years of experience for my prosecutors is the same as my predecessor, which is 8.4 years of experience, which is actually more than the combined average years of experience of my two opponents. When we talk about the politically motivated firings, again, I think that that assertion is ridiculous. And one of the reasons why I would say that is I would point to my chief deputy, who is Michael Schatzel, an esteemed attorney for who was very well known in the legal community, who was extremely close to my predecessor, who was friends with him. He supported his campaign, you know, financially, and was even at his victory party, you know, on the night of the election. So to say that I was politically motivated, again, I think it just comes with the territory. And unfortunately, change is hard for folks.
You're convinced that there isn't a culture, a tenor, a vibe in the office that is preventing really qualified, ambitious, knowledgeable lawyers from wanting to work in the state's attorney.
Absolutely not. We've recruited, from all across the country. We have some phenomenal attorneys. And like I said, the years of experience are approximately 8.4 years that they're staying in the office. For the most part, I'm extremely happy. And I think that when we point back, I don't want to use conviction rate as a metric of success, but the fact that we still have a 95% conviction rate shows that my prosecutors are talented, skilled attorneys who get in here, aren't paid a lot of money, but do their job each and every day and are dedicated to the mission of that office.
Let's talk a little bit about the turmoil that has taken place in the Baltimore Police Department. You talk about the lack of trust in the system. Mm-hmm. There was a huge lack of trust, and the perception is certainly that there remains a lack of trust between the community and the police department. There's also the perception that there's a lack of trust between the state's attorney's office and the police department, having to do with the prosecutions in Freddie Gray, having to do with the fact that this crime, I mean, the mayor herself described the crime as out of control a couple of years ago. And it just, everybody is on edge. Everybody is pointing fingers. You've got Gene Ryan, the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, being very critical of your administration.
Right.
And people read that and they say, well, you know, the cops aren't getting along with the prosecutors. So what's your take on the actual relationship between your office and the police department? And how do you think, wherever it stands now, right, how do you think it can improve in the next year?
So I think it's important to draw a distinction among the Fraternal Order of Police and the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police and police officers. What I can tell you is that, again, this is not a metric of success, but in some respects it is. 95% conviction rate, right? We rely on the police. The majority of hardworking police officers understand and recognize that we can't do this without them. And they come into court and they cooperate with my office. And this misconception that there's a chasm among my office and all police officers is just erroneous. We wouldn't have that conviction rate without that type of cooperation. When we look at, you know, my gun violence enforcement division, this was a division that was created under my administration with former Commissioner Kevin Davis, where we essentially have six Baltimore City police officers that are housed in my office, where we sit down and we strategize on how to go and strategically go after violent repeat offenders. We have a 90% conviction rate out of that division. When we look at, you know, the narcotics division, we have this opioid crisis. So one of the things that I did was I re-implemented the narcotics division within my office. where we do these long-term investigations into the opioid crisis. We had two major drug busts over the past 2 months where we weren't just going after distributors, but we were getting these fentanyl suppliers, right? That, again, is indicative of the relationship that we have with the police officers, you know, in the Baltimore Police Department. And I think it's really important for us to kind of draw a distinction, you know, between the Fraternal Order of Police, hardworking police officers who dedicate and risk their lives each and every day. I come from four generations of police officers. My grandfather was a founding member of the first Black police organization in Massachusetts. You would be hard pressed to find somebody who respects and honors police more than I do. But I think this misconception is something that's being driven and erroneously being driven by, you know, those political forces at bay.
Got to take a break. Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby is my guest for the hour. She is seeking re-election to that office. She's opposed in the primary, which is on June 26th, by two local attorneys, Ivan Bates and Thirue Vignaraja. We'll have more with State's Attorney Mosby when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming. So, Madam State's Attorney, you happen to be here on a Monday. And before we take a break, on Mondays every day, or every Monday here on our program, it is our practice to read the names of the people who have lost their lives to violence in the previous week. Mm-hmm. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2018, 117 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, two people were reported by Baltimore police as victims of homicide. They are Michael Johnson, age 25, and Quavon Johnson, who is not related to Michael Johnson. He was 24 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. She's running for re-election to the office that she has held since January of 2015. Our discussion today is part of our series of conversations with the candidates. That series includes my interviews with former prosecutor Ivan Bates and former Maryland Deputy Attorney General Thirue Vignaraja. You can find all of our conversations with the candidates when you subscribe to our podcast or when you come to wypr.org/Midday. If you have questions, comments for Marilyn Mosby, you can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Beth comments on Facebook, there is not 6 degrees of separation between people who you know and a victim of crime in Baltimore City. It's 1 degree at best. We're all affected, and it's getting worse, not better. And Sid says, ask Ms. Mosby whether she thinks the BPD should be disbanded. There is this movement. At the moment, it seems like somewhat a minor movement, but just to say, you know, it is time to just start over, fire everybody, let them all apply for their jobs to come back, and just start from scratch. Of course, here we are now in yet another search for a new police commissioner. We have this major who was like former Commissioner D'Souza, selected for this elite study program, who has now been alleged to have, you know, stolen money from a foundation set up after Freddie Gray. I mean, the number of incidents that cause people to say this police department is not a matter, it's not a matter of a few bad apples. It is just an endemic mess.
So, I mean, what's the question, Dom?
Well, the question is, I mean, do you have thoughts about a fix for it, a fix of the department, a fix of the culture that the consent decree in the Department of Justice identified, the unconstitutional behavior? Uh-huh. I mean, are there things that they're doing that you think they're on the
so
right
I'm
track?
Hopeful.
Are you confident in it? Because you've got this GTTF task force. I mean,
I know.
You know, 2,000 cases, is that the right number that are affected?
I mean, unfortunately, yes. I think when we think about GTTF and some of the scandals that have taken place within the Baltimore Police Department, it's definitely an issue, and it's definitely had an impact, not just on community trust, but it's had a direct sort of impact on my office, right? When we look at the illegal activities of the officers that go so far beyond the scope of their employment, planting guns, drugs, robbing drug dealers, redistributing drugs, getting people killed, you know, I've attempted to be as proactive and to ensure that we're pushing criminal justice reform even still. So if you look at some of the things that I can control, because at the end of the day, I can't control what happens, what the mayor decides to do with the police department. I have to work with whatever she decides. You know, we've put in place an agreement with the city solicitor to turn over problematic officers to the law department that wasn't in existence before. We put in place an agreement with the city solicitor to make all internal affairs records accessible for defense attorneys in light of that, you know, atrocious sort of corruption case. And then we're the only office in the entire state to publish our rationale for declinations of police-involved shootings and or deaths online. So we try to be as transparent about this as possible, because at the end of the day, I don't have anything to hide. And, you know, having to play cleanup is not fun at all. We've expended a great deal of resources.
Are there a lot of people who have the proclivity for very serious criminal activity released now and on the street? And is there anything you can do about those people? If those cases were tainted by the people in the Gun Trace Task Force, do you have any options? Do you have any, you know, remedies for getting, if these are really bad guys, can you get them off the street?
So what we have done is that, because public safety is our number one sort of priority, is we've made an assessment. We haven't gone in and we looked at the cases and just said, if these officers with these credibility issues were involved in the case, we're getting rid of it altogether. What we've had to do is to look at the materiality of the case. So this has required a great deal of resources, because we're looking at every single case. This may be a really bad guy, right? And if we can prove that case without having to utilize those officers, then we're going to proceed upon those cases. In those cases where the officers from the GTTF scandal are needed, and there's nothing we can do other than to say, you know, this case is tainted. Justice requires that we vacate this case. And it's been my office that has filed these motions to vacate and reaching out to defense counsel and said, you know, in the pursuit of justice, we have no other choice but to vacate this conviction or to dismiss this case. But there are certain steps if it's a really bad individual. One of the things that we have put into place is I created a crime strategies division that is a data-driven prosecution unit. We have an arrest alert system that we put into place. So oftentimes what happens is that every individual sort of criminal agency works in these silos, right? About they collect information on the same individuals. Well, from Department of, you know, Corrections, DOC, pretrial, state police, Baltimore Police Department, and even my office. We now centralize that data, and we've created an arrest alert system where we take all of that data, put it in one location, and when that individual is arrested, we provide all of that information to our prosecutors at the earliest stages of investigation. So those really bad guys that we have to get rid of as a result of the GTTF scandal, we're now placing in our arrest alert system to say, hey, let's monitor this guy. Let's ensure that this guy is not, you know, at least we have all of the information. So at the bail recommendation, we're giving proper information to the judge.
There are folks who talk a lot about the clearance rate of arrests that are made here in the city. In Baltimore County, it's 74%. In the city, it's about 50%. That's up from 30-something percent, but it's still way below what it is in other jurisdictions. The Washington Post has a report, a pretty extensive report, about cities like Baltimore, Chicago, Atlanta, comparing how the number of homicides are, how many of them are solved, how many of them are solved, where the police can come to your office and say, we know, we're confident we know who did this crime. and that there are certain areas in Baltimore and in Chicago that so few homicides are solved in these particular areas that these homicides take place with virtually no arrests. So voters need to decide, is your office making the right decisions about the cases to prosecute and the way to identify where these prosecutions should take place?
So what I can tell you is that when we look at the almost 20% increase in the number of homicides that my prosecutors have to deal with, right, the national average that you should have for a homicide prosecutor, you should have about 20 cases. My prosecutors have on average about 54. And even despite that 20% increase, last year we had an almost 80% conviction rate. But understand and recognize that when it comes to clearance rates, we live in the home of witness intimidation where the stop snitching mentality began. Not just murders, but we look at the number of robberies that took place last year. And I think it was something like 7,000. Only about 2% or something to that effect, about 700 or something, were actually solved, right? People aren't coming forward. This is what I mean about like the role of a prosecutor and being able to break down those barriers of distrust. When we look at every public enemy number one that's been convicted, an individual who lured somebody onto a playground and in broad daylight daylight shot him twice in the head in front of his pregnant girlfriend. It was not just the police who got that bad guy off the street, right? It wasn't just my prosecutors who are the most talented prosecutors in the country. The way we were able to secure that conviction was because it was Miss Gloria Hertzfeldt, who lived in that community for 40 years and said, absolutely not, not in my neighborhood. That is the man that did it. He got life plus 50 years. This is the reason why I have put so many resources in trying to break down those barriers of distrust, whether it's the community liaisons, whether it's the community days in court where we talk about the intricacies of the criminal justice system. One of the things that I put into place, because the first couple of months that I was there, I had people who were calling up and saying, I haven't heard from, you know, my detective, and my child was killed 2 years ago. What's going on with my case? Well, we put into place, and it was a culture shift in my office, right? Now, every time there's a homicide, my prosecutors are required, along with the victim witness advocate, along with the police detective, along with the family bereavement, which we're the only state attorney's office in the entire state that has a family bereavement center. We call and we reach out to the next of kin to bring them in to talk about, even before there's a person of interest, what that criminal justice process looks like. We have to be able to break down barriers of distrust, because at the end of the day, the community is the most important stake in all of this.
The average homicide victim, the people who are being shot at record numbers, I mean, over the past 3 or 4 years, the numbers are a little bit better in this particular year in 2018, but the average homicide victim had 11 previous arrests. Mm-hmm. The shooters, the people who are doing the murders, had an equal number of arrests. These are people who are not unknown to the criminal justice system. So if that's the case, if people who are committing violent crimes, who are involved in violent crimes, are shooting each other, and it's the small number of people committing the large number of crimes, why is the crime rate still so intractable and high?
So I think you just touched upon it, right? I mean, at the end of the day, their clearance rate is what it is. A lot of folks are not coming forward. We know who these perpetrators are, right? And we have to be able to ensure that they're being held accountable. And that's one of the reasons why I've impressed upon and tried to impress upon the community the importance of understanding that there are more of us productive citizens. I live in the heart of West Baltimore. I don't have to turn on the news and open up the newspaper to see the violence plague in my community. All I have to do is open up my door. And there are more of us that are invested in our communities and want to see the trajectory of our community change than there are of the small number of individuals that define that negative perception. So I've made every attempt that I can to be able to break down those barriers of distrust, to ensure that we have victim witness relocation when people want to come forward, you know, to ensure that we're having community days in court so they understand the process, ensuring that we have victims and witnesses in every homicide that understand we haven't found the person yet, but when we do find that person, this is what the criminal justice system looks like. So at the end of the day, we have to make sure that people know and understand and recognize that there are more of us than there are of them.
Marilyn Mosby has been my guest for the hour. She is the incumbent Baltimore City State's Attorney and one of three Democratic candidates for that office in the primary election that takes place 2 weeks from tomorrow. There's a week of early voting that begins on Thursday. Madam State's Attorney, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find all of my interviews with the other two candidates for Baltimore State's Attorney, the major candidates for Governor, Baltimore County Executive, and other elective offices when you subscribe to our podcast or if you go to our website, wypr.org/midday. You can follow the link to Conversations with the Candidates. That's it for us today. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking about some of the challenges confronting Americans as we cast our ballots in this year's midterm elections across the country. Max Feldman is the co-author of a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice in New York. It's called The State of Voting 2018. He'll join me, along with John Willis of the University of Baltimore School of Law, Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law, and Nikidra Robinson. She's the founder of Black Girls Vote. Barriers at the Ballot Box. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Thanks for listening. Here and Now is up next at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.